This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney, and this program is coming to you from San Francisco. Our topic is public safety. Should juveniles who commit serious crimes get rehabilitation or serve adult prison sentences? My guests are Judge Eugene Hyman, Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired, Frankie Guzman, attorney, the National Center for Youth Law, Stephen Wagstaff, District Attorney of San Mateo County, Chris Ariola, Supervising Deputy District Attorney of the Juvenile Unit, Santa Clara County, and Jeff Hayden, Defense Attorney, Certified Specialist in Criminal Law, and President of the San Mateo County Bar Association. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California and by the San Mateo County Bar Association. Public radio satellite transmission is funded by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Additional funding of the program is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. For those of you who are listening to the program live, and we are doing this live on April 29th, in the second half hour of the program, you'll have a chance to call in, ask a question, make a comment if you wish. Maybe you'd like to jot down our toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I'm going to start with Frankie Guzman, who's an attorney, and you might be surprised about this, but at age 15, Frankie was convicted of armed robbery, sentenced to 15 years in the California Youth Authority. He served six, was released on parole. He subsequently, shortly thereafter, I believe, enrolled in Oxnard College, transferred to UC Berkeley with a BA in English, and then graduated from UCLA Law School. Frankie, with your experience, and now you've had such a, today, successful life in the last few years, give us a little perspective about what you went through and what you would like others to know about.
Sure. Thank you for having me on the show, Chuck.
My pleasure.
You know, one thing that I would like to start off by saying is my background, my experience growing up is very similar to that which many young people in California and indeed across the nation experience in low-income communities and especially communities of color. I grew up in a single-parent home with a mother who's an immigrant, limited education, and who worked very long hours and essentially, you know, I relied on my older brother to take care of me and my sister. At a very young age, my older brother was arrested and charged with committing murder at age 16, was prosecuted as an adult and ultimately found guilty and given a 17-to-life sentence. Today, 30 years later, he's still in prison on that conviction. As you can imagine, this experience had a serious impact, a deep impact in me, to where it really soured me, I think. Being in that courtroom and hearing what the judge said about my brother, and specifically around him being a straight-A student and being a good student, was used as an indication of his sophistication and his criminality. It really made me believe that being in school was not a good thing, that would eventually come back to haunt me. And so I really disengaged in that kind of way. But, you know, one thing that I also kind of internalized was, this is my brother. He's basically my role model, and no matter what anyone says about him, he's like a god to me. And so I looked up to him growing up. In my community, there wasn't a whole lot of opportunities. There wasn't a whole lot of, positive interaction with adults. Many of the people in my community were down and out, you know, on drugs, in jail, you know, and the like. And so as a result, I grew up kind of following in my brother's footsteps. I became a gang member. In school, I would say I struggled a lot. Safety concerns were always an issue, you know, being jumped and the like. By the time I was in high school, my GPA was 0.8, not because I wasn't a good student, but because I seriously was distracted by fear. And always, I think, at top of my, you know, kind of foremost in my mind was survival. While in the community, however, you know, I was dealt with, you know, I think other challenges and issues, you know, with respect to gangs, also the stop and frisk issues with law enforcement, to where I really felt as if I was being attacked from all angles, you know, from law enforcement, from the other young kids around in my community. At school, it was not a safe place. And so I think this kind of created a condition or an environment where I really didn't have a whole lot of hope for my life, my outlook was very dark and dim. So that, you know, when I had my friends, to me, those were the one and only thing that I could really count on, or so I believed. One day, my friend, when I was 15, he was 16, asked me if I would help him by accompanying him on a robbery. I initially said no, but after feeling, you know, these feelings of codependency, I initially thought, what would happen to my friend if, or what would I do if something happened bad happened to my friend? And I changed my mind. I ultimately went with him.
Let me do this, if you would, Frankie, because I would like the audience to know you have now been with the National Center for Youth Law for some years.
3 years now.
What is your goal in terms of your own personal experience that you've gone through? What is your goal for other juveniles who have committed serious crime? What would you like to see happen?
My goal for every juvenile that has committed a serious crime is that that they be held accountable, but that in holding them accountable, that they are treated with respect and dignity, that they are educated in a way that they learn from their mistakes, and in a way that they not only restore the person that they harm, but that they too are restored, because I believe that hurt people hurt people. And overwhelmingly, these kids who commit serious crimes are kids who suffer from abuse, abandonment, and neglect. And to ignore that just because they commit some type of act that we don't agree with, it's not a reason to just treat them inhumanely or as an adult, as we would an adult.
Because if I may interrupt, if you don't mind, in adult prison, there is no rehabilitation.
That's right.
Is that generally correct?
That is generally correct.
Is that correct, Mr. Wagstaff?
Well, no, it's not, actually. Okay. There's not a lot. I mean, but now prison, which has been cut down by about a good 60,000 people, today they do have programs up there. Not what I'd like to have, not what they had 25 years ago. But there still is an entire wing down at Corcoran Prison that is devoted entirely, 2,500 prisoners, strictly to drug education being run through the Walden program. So it's not what we want. I very much agree with Frankie on that. It's not that there's none.
But in the juvenile system, the juvenile justice system, rehabilitation is a very important part of it, is it not?
It's the number one priority.
Okay. Let me do this, if you don't, because there's so many issues that we need to cover and time goes too quickly. Jeff Hayden, president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. Jeff, give us a little bit of history about Prop 21, before and after, and then I'd like to turn to Chris Areola of the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office to take off from you. Go ahead, Jeff, if you would.
Through the latter half of the 20th century, if a young person under 18 committed what would be a crime in an adult court, they would have their case filed in the juvenile court. If the DA filed what's called a fitness petition, they would be asking the court to rule on whether this young person was amenable to the care and treatment of the juvenile court. And you would have a judicial determination looking at five criteria, but ultimately it looked at the nature of the offense and the nature of the minor, whether they could reach out and turn him around or not, whether he or she had already exhausted the system. Also looking at the crime itself and how serious it was. It was changed somewhat in the middle 1990s in that up until that time, someone had to be 16 or 17. By the mid-1990s, they added additional serious offenses for people that are 14 and 15. Still had to go through the court. In the most serious offenses, there was a presumption that this young person was not amenable and that their case should go to adult court. They should ultimately suffer adult punishment. Once they go up, there was no provision to send them back. The world changed for young people that were accused, starting with the passage of Proposition 21 in the year 2000. From that point forward, there was really a three-tier system. There were some offenses, such as rape in concert or a case of murder where the minor charge was actually named as the person who committed the murder, where the juvenile court has no jurisdiction. And the DA had no discretion but to direct file that case. In most other serious cases, the prosecution has the sole authority to decide should this young person go through the previous procedure, which they do in some counties. A court will determine it. They weigh the five factors. And it gives a chance for everyone to explore whether that person should stay or go to adult. Whether to just file in the juvenile court and keep the person there, or whether they decided that they are going to file in adult court directly. Mm-hmm. And there's still very, very limited means to send them back once that happens. Now, the prosecution...
So when you say send them back to juvenile...
Send them back to juvenile court.
Yes.
The prosecution can change course and alter their filing, or if ultimately after trial or after a finding of guilt, it turns out that there's not a serious offense that was sustained and it's left with something far, far less serious, they can be sent from adult court back to juvenile court for punishment. Otherwise, once they're in adult court, they're going to stay there.
And isn't it correct, though, that if someone, if a juvenile is prosecuted in adult court, and sent to state prison, that juvenile is going to spend, generally speaking, a lot more time in adult prison as opposed to being in juvenile, the youth authority?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
They can go up on a serious offense and get a shorter sentence depending on the nature of what was sustained and what kind of a sentence the person got. There is a limit to how long that the young person can stay in the youth authority if they're sent from the juvenile court. But they could conceivably get a short sentence to prison, or they could conceivably get a probationary sentence in adult court. So there are some relief mm-hmm. valves. What there aren't is there aren't really effective, really any rehabilitative programs. If they're in adult mm-hmm. court, we're looking at punishing them. We're looking at retribution. We're looking at more of a general deterrence to others like them, but not so much at rehabilitation. That's the province of the juvenile court.
Let me go to Chris Areola, Santa Clara County DA's office, if you would, Chris.
Sure. We've spent a lot of time looking at direct file cases over the last 4 years. We've hired the Burns Institute in San Francisco to take a look at it, and it's really opened our eyes that around the country there are several different schemes. For example, in about 20-odd states around the country, if you're 16 or 17, depending on the state, if you commit a felony, you are automatically filed on in adult court. Mm-hmm. There are discretionary valves to go back, but the you are taken to adult court. So California is somewhere in the middle of where you see states, and there are about 14 or 15 states that have similar structures to California that allow the district attorney to have discretion in these decisions and to exercise that or to have the court make decisions. And so when we look at that, I think it's important to kind of take a look at how California compares to other states. And I think we have a good system because the worst offenders can be taken to adult court. Some can stay in juvenile court with the option to go up, or we can keep kids, which I think in the Bay Area is what you see more, except for the very violent crimes, that they tend to stay in juvenile. I do agree, though, that with some people who say you will see a very different administration of that discretion by the district attorney, making the decision to go to adult or not, depending on what county you're in. And I think you'll find that throughout the criminal justice system, though, if you're talking and comparing Fresno County to San Francisco County to San Diego County, I think you're going to see a very different form of justice that is right for that community, but that some people may or may not agree with.
I think, Chris, if I may, Jeff had a couple of questions for you. Would you pose that to Chris? Jeff,
thank you.
Please.
Actually, I had two. One of them had to do with other states that are direct filing. Can you describe some of the valves that would let the court send some of the juvenile offenders back to adult court? I know that's something that was in effect for a long time that we did not embrace in California. And the other question while you're discussing other states is, I don't know the answer, candidly. If some of the other states you've looked at have incorporated some of the rehabilitative measures into adult court, which we clearly have not in California.
And yes and no, it really varies. For example, New York recently changed their laws so that 17-year-olds are not automatically taken to adult court. And I would say no, that the adult courts are not designed in the same rehabilitative sense as juveniles. I would push back a little bit, you know, the realignment, though. We had about 20% of our direct file kids get local sentences. Perhaps they were aiders and abettors in the crime. Perhaps they were 17 and 11 months and the juvenile system couldn't offer them anything in terms of rehabilitation, but it was a serious crime. So we direct filed it, and that person is going to be on 3 or 5 years of supervision, but may end up in drug court or mental health court which are very rehabilitative adult programs on the local level. So we do see that. So I think there's a broad range there. I do think that the sentences are going to be greater in adult court generally than in juvenile court, but that's not always the case.
Mr. Wagstaff, Steve Wagstaff, would you briefly define realignment so that people who are not familiar with it understand what it is in California?
In October of 2011, the California legislature enacted legislation, the governor signed it, to deal with the prison overcrowding, a three-judge panel court.
The adult prison overcrowding.
We were as high as 180,000 people at one point. And a law was passed that, a multiplicity of laws, that had certain crimes for which the person, if convicted, could not go to the California Department of Corrections. Instead, they would have to be housed, if it was felt prison was appropriate, in the county jail. Mm-hmm. And that would vary from county to county, but it certainly accomplished the goal of bringing down the state prison population and created a new issue here on the local level of how do we deal with these men and women. And the realignment law has been in effect now for going on 3.5 years, and all counties throughout the state are dealing with it, and we've all adjusted to it.
This is your Legal Rights coming to you from San Francisco. We are doing a topic of public safety. The subtitle, Should Juveniles Who Commit Serious Crimes Get Rehabilitation or Serve Adult Prison Sentences? I have some very significant people who are my guests here, and let me tell you who they are. Jeff Hayden is the president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. He's a defense attorney. Chris Arriola is supervising deputy district attorney of the juvenile unit for Santa Clara County DA's office. Stephen Wagstaff is the district attorney of San Mateo County. Frankie Guzman is an attorney with the National Center for Youth Law, and Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired, is also here. Judge Hyman, you brought this topic to my attention at least a couple of months ago. There was an article in the Mercury News about this. You were very concerned about this, and you wanted me to start looking into doing this program. And frankly, that's why we're doing it, because of you, Judge. Your concerns are what? You spent 5 years presiding over the juvenile court in Santa Clara County. What are your concerns?
Well, I was there prior to Prop 21 being passed, so the only way that cases could go to adult court would be through petitions for determination whether or not the person was fit or not, commonly referred to as fitness hearings. My number one concern, I guess, is transparency. When we're talking about 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds going into adult court, I'm concerned about that the process be one that be examined, that the public understand how their local DA's office is doing things. I certainly recognize the discretion of the prosecutor. I recognize as the executive branch that they have the right to do things as they deem fit, and I'm certainly not trying to tell them what to do. I'm just saying that it be transparent in terms of what they do. In fairness to them, they have to make a decision regarding to file a direct file or to file in juvenile very quickly after the arrest. They don't have a lot of time. They don't have a lot of time to do a lot of social investigation in terms of they can look at the records, obviously, but they have to make a very quick decision within a couple of days. So I think that's even more important, therefore, that there be transparency in terms of how decision-making is done. I'm concerned about school suspensions because we have an expression in juvenile court, can't read, go to prison.
And can't read, go to prison.
Because of the high correlation between kids who don't graduate high school and who can't read and write and how they wind up in the criminal justice system, adult and a juvenile. And I also have concerns about how people wind up in juvenile court. By that, I mean individual prosecutors, judges, probation officers, defense attorneys, criminal defense attorneys, public defenders in those counties that have them. In some counties, it's all new people go there. In some counties, it's punishment. In some counties, it's an undesirable assignment. And I think that when you're dealing with children, whether it be in family court, juvenile delinquency court, also called juvenile justice in some counties, and juvenile dependency, abuse, and neglect. You want everyone who's there top-notch. We're dealing with children. I mean, there's nothing more important in my my perspective. Children. With respect to what we do with children in terms of dispositions, which is the word that's used in terms of sentencing is what would be used in adult court, best practices, evidence-based programming. Unfortunately, too many people want to treat juveniles as little adults and say—
When you say too many people, are you talking about prosecutors?
I'm talking about everyone.
Everyone in the legal system?
I'm not discriminating.
Not everyone. All right.
I'm saying that there are too many people who feel that, you know, if you do certain kinds of things, there needs to be serious kinds of consequences. And I probably wouldn't have as much of a problem with that if the consequences were evidence-based and if we knew that, in fact, that what we do in terms of dispositions or sentencing, that it's likely to get the result that we want, that is, that people reform. You know, we talk about disproportionate minority confinement and disproportionate minority people winding up in our juvenile system as well as winding up in the adult system or winding up in direct file. I want to be very clear. I don't for one second say that disproportionate findings is because of racism. I don't believe that for one second. I don't believe that there is somehow an organizational determination to try and railroad people because of their backgrounds. I think it's unfortunate that we have such differences in terms of populations and who winds up, but I don't think it's because of any preordained plan by anyone. I think what happens is that a lot of people don't have resources, as Frankie discussed during his presentation, that people don't have parents that are involved. If you don't have involved parents, you're more likely to be in the system, and you're more likely to be petitioned or charged, and you're more likely to be on formal probation because you don't have anyone else supervising you at home.
I have a couple of questions for you. We have about 5 minutes left in the statewide version of the program. For those of you listening to us live, whether it's the Bay Area, whether it's on the Internet, or whether it's on the satellite, we will continue for another half hour after this first half hour. But, Judge, let me ask you this. Do you think that most DA's offices, as far as California are concerned, feel that punishment is what's going to get them reelected and therefore this is a political thing?
Yeah, that's tough for me to say.
All right, let me ask you another question.
Let me try. I think it depends upon the county that you're in. You have 58 counties in California and 58 different ways of looking at it. You know, every prosecutor is charged with the responsibility of doing the ethical thing in terms of bringing charges that are appropriate to the totality of the circumstances, not just what they can prove and convict. They have to do what's fair. Same thing with judges in terms of their responsibilities. So it, in the Bay Area, I don't think that's the motivator. In certain areas of California, I think that it is.
Frankie, what do you think?
I think that there's a lot of factors that go into the decision to prosecute a kid as an adult. And the often cited reason is the victims. Another one is the voters gave us this right. You know, but when you look at the research and, you know, when you ask victims what would they prefer, rehabilitation over incarceration for their violent offenders, overwhelmingly victims of violent crime say that they would prefer rehabilitative services for their offenders. Prosecutors are not saying this. And to the issue that he raised earlier, it is true that black and brown kids overwhelmingly are impacted by direct file charges. And to say that it's motivated by racism, I think, is also a little too strong. But I do understand that there is this thing called implicit bias. We all have it. You know, we all are biased implicitly.
Yeah.
And there was tons
we
of research.
We may not admit to it,
right.
But we do.
You don't need to admit to it. We know it exists. And the part of implicit bias or the research shows us that black and brown kids are perceived as being much older than what they are. There's a researcher named Goff who his research shows black kids are perceived as being 4 years older than what they are. So at young as 14 years old, they're viewed as adults.
As an 18-year-old.
whereas white kids who commit violent crimes is viewed as being kids well into their 20s. And so who gets the benefit and who gets the harm of implicit bias? But ultimately, you know, when we talk about fairness, if that is truly the DA's mandate and their charge, then we need to understand that kids are not many adults, and kids are not just their conduct. If we talk about trauma and we understand crime as through a trauma-informed lens, we understand that people who experience trauma respond to threats and danger differently. If I am threatened with something that I perceive as danger and I react violently, it isn't because I'm a monster. It's because I am reacting out of this, you know, this reaction because of trauma, out of survival. Why is it fair then to prosecute this kid to the fullest extent of the law, in many cases, for decades, when we know that treatment there will actually create a monster? If we educate him and help him heal, he will stop committing these crimes. We know research again has showed first-time offenders overwhelmingly never reoffend. And for those that do, they always stop, they age out by age 25.
Here's Areola.
Yeah, and I just want to say, you know, prosecutors have a very difficult job, as people might know, and we do take it extremely seriously. There are injustices in society that we see. But, you know, when I look at a case and I have a young person who's on probation for violent crimes and they walk up, and I've had these cases, walk up to somebody pushing a baby stroller, his child with his girlfriend, and walk up, put a gun to the back of his head because he's wearing a blue shirt, and shoot him. I think that the direct file law is appropriate. I had a 14-year-old, and I have to be honest with you, I had sleepless nights thinking about this case. I look at this 14-year-old who took a gun and shot another young man from a few feet away because he didn't know him because he was wearing a blue shirt and he was in a rival gang. And we have to have the power because, yes, maybe that person won't be rehabilitated or can be, but who's going to take the chance that he's going to go in our community and kill someone else if we don't file on him in adult court? And that's what we weigh every day. And we try to keep kids in juvenile court if we can. That's our preference. But our higher calling in those difficult cases is that we have to protect the public that we serve.
We have about 15 seconds left. I want to let all of you know that for those of you who are listening to the program live, we will continue. This is April 29th. I'll give you the phone number in just a minute. We have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. For those of you listening to us on April 29th, we will be back in just a few seconds. Okay, it is your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Your Legal Rights is public radio coming to you from San Francisco. We are now, I'm very pleased to say, on the public radio satellite, which is funded by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. I'm Chuck Finney, the host of this program. Let me tell you, if you've tuned in a little bit late, our topic is public safety. Should juveniles who commit serious crimes get rehabilitation or serve adult prison sentences? If you have a question, a comment, or would like to join us on the air with what you feel might be important to have everybody else hear, the number, toll-free number, is 866-798-8255. Toll-free again, number 866-798-8255. Let me tell you who my guests are. Judge Eugene Hyman, Santa Clara County Superior Court, retired. Frankie Guzman, attorney, the National Center for Youth Law. Stephen Wagstaff, District Attorney, San Mateo County. Chris Areola, Supervising Deputy District Attorney of the Juvenile Unit, Santa Clara County. And Jeff Hayden, Defense Attorney, Certified Specialist in Criminal Law, and President of the San Mateo County Bar Association. Here's a question for you, by the way, gentlemen. And this comes from one of our listeners. I read somewhere that in the average annual cost per juvenile is over $200,000. There's an exclamation mark and a question mark here. Why does it cost so much? Question mark. Does anyone want to respond to this? Frankie Guzman, please.
Yeah, I think what they're referring to is the cost the cost of keeping a kid in the California Youth Authority or our state system. Back in the 1990s, when I was in that system, there was over 10,000 kids in that system, and it cost about $50,000 to keep each individual ward there. But after a lot of litigation to remedy a lot of abuses constitutional human rights abuses. The cost that it takes to get into compliance raised the cost per ward, as well as the fact that a lot of counties, because of these abuses becoming widely known around the state, many jurisdictions divested from the youth authority and stopped sending their kids there. So now, you know, with when you combine what it costs to come into compliance with the consent decrees, as well as the increased overhead with the limited amount of people, it costs $250,000 to send a kid to the youth authority.
Here's the second part of this question from this listener. Maybe we should move juveniles to adult prisons. It would cost less, and this person believes that the cost per year for someone in adult prison is $50,000. Judge Hyman, what do you say to that?
Well, no, because they're not going to be able to receive any rehabilitation services that are meaningful. And yes, there are services available, but not for everyone in terms of the adult system. The more likely to get services within the juvenile system. The other concern, though, that's brought up by that is that in terms of the limitations that prosecutors and the courts have available to them in terms of what to do with juveniles who are offenders, you can't send them to the county jail as a sentence because of a case that says that you can't.
Of their age?
No. Because when they turn 18, you can't
send
them there.
Yeah, okay.
You can't, as a juvenile disposition or sentence, you can't send them to the county jail. You can house them in the county jail temporarily, but you can't sentence them or disposition them.
Okay.
And that's because of an appellate case, actually from our district in San Jose. With respect to the youth authority, there's a limitation in terms of 2 years in terms of how long you can keep them. You have a ranch, but ranches may not be locked. The only place that can be locked other than the youth authority is juvenile hall. Mm-hmm. And juvenile hall really isn't a long-term source of rehabilitation, certainly on a short-term basis, perhaps, but not. You really aren't supposed to use the halls for dispositional purposes in terms of long-term confinement. So there really is a limitation of where you can keep people for a long-term period. Also, when you put a person in the youth authority, they determine how long they're going to stay. The court and the DA don't determine that. That's determined by someone else. So when you add all that up, it causes difficulties. But under no circumstances would I support sending juveniles to state prison. That's the last place I want them.
Anybody? Okay, Jeff Hayden, please.
Implicit in those two questions is the question of rehabilitation and recidivism. Mm. And what nobody's addressed so far is that the juvenile courts have a very, very successful rate of knocking out recidivism. Before Prop 21, when they were more challenged, they faced more serious offenders. 85% of the young people that came into the juvenile justice system had one, maybe two issues that brought them there, one or two cases, and they would move on. They would get the message, they would move on. There was about another 8% that maybe needed to be hit on the head a couple more times. And maybe they were a pest, maybe they came back on probation violations fairly regularly, but they eventually, the light bulb came on, they got it, they moved on. 7% were hardcore, delinquent-oriented, and they went on to be my adult clients years later. And the courts have tried throughout the state and, in fact, throughout the nation to come up with solutions to address how do you reach these kids. They've called them all collectively the 7% solution, but the number doesn't really change. But you've got a 93% success rate at turning around the kids that come into the juvenile system. There's nothing comparable or even close in the Department of Corrections. They have a 65-70% failure rate of everybody introduced on parole. So when you look at those two things, those numbers, those costs, you want to know why it's justified? It's justified because it works, because it not only saves the lives of the kids that are going into the system, but it also means your house doesn't get broken into because we've turned this kid around.
And Chris Ariola.
Yeah. Chris Ariola,
I agree. I think the juvenile justice system is worth it. And when we're talking about direct files, we're talking about that 7%.
Okay.
And even only a small percentage of those who we don't believe that the juvenile system will work for.
Let me invite you again, in case you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment with my guests. It's 866. This is toll-free, by the way, 866 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Support for this program is made by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, for those of you in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation, both in San Francisco and Marin County. And for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, that's in California, if you're listening outside of California, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, and hopefully in other states throughout the United States, there is a comparable type of lawyer referral service. If you have this, at least in California, a problem, and you call lawyer referral, tell them what the problem is. They'll try to find someone who's experienced with the problem that you have, set you up for a half an hour consultation, and with rare exception in California, a half an hour consultation, you will pay $25 to $35. It's a great way to get some basic information. So again, the number 866-798-8255. And Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Great. I want to thank you for bringing together this panel on this important issue. I'm a former probation officer with Alameda County for 10 years and also a court officer. So I understand the issue. And I want to say, theoretically, I believe that the statement that we're protecting the public by this prosecutorial decision to direct file and remand children to adult court is not serving long-term public safety. It's actually doing the opposite. And I think, as Frankie Guzman pointed out, victims of crime are much more interested in rehabilitation than they are in punishment. What I feel like what it comes down to is, are we willing to invest in kids? And are we willing to invest in kids that some people might consider broken? Mm-hmm. So I would like just to state for the record that I totally am against, you know, having juveniles be remanded to adult court. I've worked with over 1,000 young people who've gone through the juvenile justice system, and honestly, I would say there were about two that I felt were beyond our scope of rehabilitation.
And that was Alameda
we're
County.
Talking about these, yeah, this is Alameda County.
Yeah. Well,
so this, yeah. Thank
go
you.
Ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead, Deborah.
I want to put that out because I don't think we have to use these extreme examples of kids who go up to people who have strollers and shoot them at gunpoint. A lot of these direct files are first-time offenders. Sometimes they're 16 years old. Maybe they're a co-participant in a carjacking where there was no injury to the victim. They could do potentially 5 years at CYA, what we call Division of Juvenile Justice now, and get rehabilitative services. Or we could lock them up in adult prison where they don't get anything, and they come back more damaged, and that risks my public safety as a citizen and a community member.
Let me get some comments from my guests. I thank you, Deborah, for calling. Thank you very much for joining us on the program on your legal rights. The number again is 866-798-8255, wherever you are. It would be nice to know if there are any of you who are in other states who are listening and are calling in. I'd like to, when we find, or when I call on you, I'd like to know what state you are calling from, if it is other than California. Any comments for Deborah? Frankie Guzman, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think when we direct file on youth, we're sending the message that you are discardable. We're not going to tolerate you. And so what they end up learning from that is intolerance. And I do work in the prisons, and so I do know what's available to them. And it's an environment of racism, extreme violence, very few opportunities. And if we expect to improve public safety by sending young people who adapt to their environments and will basically absorb all this hate and violence and come out worse, if that's going to actually improve public safety, I think it's just an error of judgment. But what I will say is this: overwhelmingly, the kids that we direct file are not the worst of the worst. You know, the examples that Chris gave do, in fact, exist, and I think that those cases are ones that we should definitely look at more seriously. But for the majority, these cases are robbery cases, they're assault. How we describe the charge at trial or whatever is largely, I think, how we perceive it. A battery in one county might be an attempted murder in another county. Mm-hmm. And so, really, where do we draw the line? I think, ultimately, if we are going to choose to prosecute a child as an adult, that decision should be made by a judge with all the information before him around about his history, his background, the pros and the cons of who this kid is, and really what does he need. I do not believe that there are very many kids who are incorrigible. I think if we were to invest in these kids and treat them with love and dignity and respect, they would turn around. I was one of those kids. I went through the CYA system. Experienced extreme chaos, came out far worse than I went in, but it wasn't until I got to community college, in spite of what I experienced in the juvenile justice system in DJJ, I was able to change my life around because I met people who I found cared about me, and they educated me, and they gave me love. And that was the first time in my life that I was presented with this question: what do you want to do with your life, and how can we help you achieve that? I had never had that in the 6 years that I spent in the prison system.
Well, you certainly are a great example of success.
Thank
There's
you.
No question about that. We've got Andre. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. This is a question especially for the judge. I'd like to have some more information about youth who are experiencing mental health issues. I know they're hard to diagnose on the spot. Are there services in the 58 counties that can treat these mental issues that could help them in this whole process?
Well, certainly more so now than they were several years ago. Several years ago, when I first started in 99, they weren't even diagnosing a lot of mental health issues for juveniles on a theory that they wouldn't be able to diagnose until people were at least in their 20s. So that thinking has changed, and they're diagnosing, when appropriate, people much sooner. In terms of the services that are available, to a certain extent, it depends upon the counties. Most of your Bay Area counties, I think, do have good mental health services. If you have a juvenile, and this would be unusual, who really had significant mental health issues to the extent that the person was pleading not guilty by reason of insanity, that doesn't happen very often. And when it does, it presents some difficulties because the law really isn't as defined for juveniles in the same way that it is for the adult system. But the good news is that for most counties it exists.
Yeah, and I would, Chris Areola, just...
Chris Areola.
I would just jump in on the previous caller, too. I just want to be clear that we're talking about 1% to 2% of all juveniles who are referred for felonies might be direct filed. It's a very small number.
1% to 2%.
Yeah, for felonies referrals, and I think that's about right. And so, just want to be clear, we're talking about. I agree with Frankie when you move about close to half of our direct files were murder or attempted murder, but there were a lot of robberies and carjackings, and those are harder calls. And what we do look at is...
You're talking about Santa Clara County.
Yeah.
Your approach.
And we do have a Bay Area meeting of supervisors of juvenile and in the district attorney's office, and we talk about what our practices are, and I will tell you, though, whether it's using the court fitness process or direct filing, those are going to be really serious cases. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. Are there cases where a kid who's 17 and 11 months might not be able to be offered services in juvenile, and when we direct file, they might get a year in county jail and get sent to drug court or mental health court, and that might be more appropriate, and we can feel better because they're going to be on adult supervision versus mm-hmm. going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
About 20%
mm-hmm.
of our direct file kids don't go to prison but get a local sentence, and we talked about the services that are available. So there's a wide range here, but I do agree with Frankie. I mean, it is a very difficult decision, and it's not always an easy one to make.
Steve Wagstaff, do you have some comments on this?
I'd echo what was said by the judge, Chris, and Frankie. I agree with it. San Mateo County, we're known to be a rather aggressive conservative county. In the last 18 months, we've probably had a total of over 1,000 kids come through our juvenile system. Not all felonies, but the most are. And we've had two cases we have filed direct file on. We're extremely selective on it. And if it were as a young man who committed a robbery and hadn't really had the benefit of juvenile services before, San Mateo County, that case is not going to go into adult court. We wouldn't do that. Our cases are like Chris says. They tend to be more in the murder or attempted murder, and that's the way our county works, and we're a conservative county, a DA's office at least, I should say.
Jeff Hayden.
My experience in San Mateo County is obviously far more limited than Mr. Wagstaff's, but I have seen some less serious offenders without serious records being served direct filed an adult. And unlike that which Chris just said, in Santa Clara County, they still retain access to the mental health court, to drug court, to various rehabilitative programs within the court system. San Mateo County, far less so. I know that throughout other parts of the state, even less so. If they're serving in adult court because of a serious offense, they're not allowed to participate in the drug court or the mental health court in San Mateo County. That's reserved for people that are not facing serious felonies.
Steve Wagstaff is shaking his head. Well, no, you're not right, Jeff.
Obviously, I'm extremely familiar with our mental health court because I attended a great deal for our office. And the answer is we have had arsonists in our mental health court. We have – there's no limit on violence. Drug court, though, Jeff's right. That mm-hmm. certainly – that is for strictly low-level drug offenders. But for us, it's different.
Frankie Guzman.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to add another layer of complexity here, right? I mean, as we all agree, the decision to direct file is a serious one that has serious, long-lasting consequences just by virtue of the fact if you're convicted, you get a felony, which will restrict all sorts of housing, employment, whether you can go to college and the like. But there's also the consequences that occur in the court. You know, oftentimes prosecutors stack on gang enhancements, gun enhancements, which raise the level of consequence to something near a life term. For example, in 2013, I worked with a kid who out of San Mateo County who was 16 years old and had discharged his firearm in the air in public. He didn't hit anything. He didn't hit anyone. He was prosecuted as an adult. His charge of assault had a three-year underlying sentence, but with the gun enhancement that increased it to 20 years more, so that's 23 years. With the gang enhancement, that became 33 years. So he faced 33 years if he went to court and lost on these allegations, understanding that fighting a gang case is extremely the risks are great. He took a deal. The only deal that he was offered was 18 years in prison with two strikes. The question that I would ask is, what interest are we furthering by treating kids this way and coming down on them so hard when I would consider this a victimless crime? I know we might debate that issue, but really, I as a victim of violent crime myself, I do not agree with this approach, especially when we're talking about kids who, I'm telling you, that kid might not have been a monster before he went in, but when he gets out, I have
he's
questions.
A monster. Any comments to respond to Frankie Guzman?
I have just one. You know,
Judge Hyman.
Mr. Guzman has obviously benefited from self-rehabilitation, if not from anything else. And the irony is, if he had been direct filed on as an adult, he would not be a lawyer here today.
He certainly would not be.
Because no law school would have accepted him, certainly not UCLA, He would not have been eligible to have taken the bar because the state bar would not have allowed him to sit for the bar with the felony that he suffered. So thank God he did not go through the adult system. With respect to if I had my druthers as a judge, I'd like to see every case go through the fitness rather than direct file, but that's not the law. And
You'd like to see a judge make the decision.
Yes, I would. Okay. In the 5 years I was
in... But isn't there a problem with that? Isn't there a problem
sure,
with that?
Of course.
Because in California, all judges are up for election.
That's
it's
true.
A political
that's
issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But pardon me, go ahead.
No, you're 100% correct. I mean, do we have total judicial independence when you have an elected system? I suggest that you don't. In the 4 or 5 cases, because I didn't have many fitness cases, but they were the serious ones, and my recollection is that they were all found to be unfit. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times...
Unfit for...
Juvenile.
They
went to the adult system, the 4 or 5 that I recall having. However, there were a number of cases that were filed for fitness, and they resolved with the juvenile staying in the juvenile system but going to the youth authority. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, what I'm hearing from our discussion is that a lot of direct files or some direct files occur in terms of for purposes of accountability, for public safety, and for other considerations along those lines. And that concerns me that someone, I guess, has to usually in our system of justice, the judge ultimately makes the sentencing choice, the exception being a death penalty case, of course. But usually it's the judge that decides in terms of the sentence within the parameters of mandatory sentencing and things like that. But here, when you have direct file, in essence, it's the district attorney, for the most part, that's determining considerations with respect to length of time. Because by filing it in the adult court and filing it with certain allegations in terms of arming and gang and things of that nature, the district attorney is controlling, at least with respect to a floor, in terms of how much time the person is ultimately going to serve. So in my ideal world, it would be a judge that would be determining the fitness or lack thereof. Also, in my...
Would that be an ideal judge?
Yeah, an ideal judge. Well, the law is the law, and I certainly, as I said before, I certainly recognize the executive branch's prerogatives. But the other thing that I think is important to emphasize in terms of this path, in terms of having difficulties in winding up potentially committing crimes and being determined to be unfit, has to do with resources that are available for those families where parents, due to economic circumstances, are unable to be available. Mm-hmm. Because show me someone who has an involved set of parents, or at least one parent who's greatly involved, and that person's more eligible for different kinds of diversionary programs within the juvenile system. They're less likely to be filed on because the system isn't as concerned about outcomes. Whereas if no one is involved, then the feeling is that they need probationary services. So there's a filing, and then they progress, a certain percentage of them progress along the line and then become more deeply involved. I mean, there's no question in my mind that if you do a significant period of time in juvenile hall, you might pick up some ideas in terms of criminality.
We have someone who's been waiting to talk with you, and that's Ralph. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chuck. I want to thank you and your staff and KALW for this Wednesday night every week.
Well, thank you, Ralph, for saying that.
You know, Chuck, the problem is that we're talking about the police and the courts is symptomatic of the real issues, and the real issues are four: financial inequality, social injustice, racism here in the United States, and the American version of apartheid. And I don't say that easily. It's just that, you know, we keep going about this, and we don't want to put any money into societals changing what is a terrible outrage to thousands and thousands of people.
Well, I thank you, Ralph, for calling in and making, you know, those comments. Let me get Chrissy Arriola to respond.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And every day as prosecutors, you know, I also supervise our crime prevention unit. We have three DAs who work on truancy and prevention. And I can tell you, you know, the studies tell us if we can cut the high school dropout rate, we will cut the crime rate.
Mm-hmm.
If you, a kid who graduates from high school is extremely unlikely to commit murder. And we need to put more resources into schools, and schools in poor communities work on truancy and dropout and parental support and parental education. And we put money into that because we know that you can't just prosecute your way out of problems. You've got to work on the front end as well.
Steve Wagstaff.
Yeah, I very much agree with what Chris says, but it goes back earlier. In San Mateo County, we have a program countywide, all departments, both criminal justice, social services, called the Big Lift, because the real issue is at third grade. If third grade reading, if you fall behind by third grade, after third grade, if you're not there, it's a tough road after that. We know our success rate really fails there. So in our county, we're devoting both for health purposes, for reading, everything else, we're targeting to make sure that for every kid in our county, we do it. Get that third grade reading level, get the education level up, get the health level up, and then we think we can accomplish what Chris just mentioned at the high school. We think it has to go back even earlier, and that's why in San Mateo County, everybody is participating in the Big Lift.
Jeff Hayden.
This is one area where I completely agree with my friends across the aisle. I cut my teeth in this in Compton, learned a lot about how gang members were behaving back then. It's been a long time. But one of the things that surprised me is that We think of cutting school with the bad kids in high school. It's actually something that in a lot of sectors in our society, people stop going to school for lots of reasons that have nothing to do with individual choice, have to do with family dynamics, have to do with feeling threatened, have to do with the dynamics in their neighborhood. But by the sixth grade, they've stopped going. Fourth grade, fifth grade, they're tapering off. By sixth grade, they're done. Their names are on the roll, but they never go there.
Hmm. Wow.
Well, the other thing we have to identify is people with educational deficiencies in terms of ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, things like that. And if we aren't able to intervene appropriately early on, then you get the kinds of problems that you're talking about.
And, you know, we do have problems in our education.
Chris Areola.
In our educational pipeline. You know, only as a Latino lawyer myself, only 4% of all lawyers in the state of California are Latino, even though 40% of the population is. So we have institutional problems in terms of educational outcomes. Mm-hmm. Only like 9% of college graduates in the state are Latino, yet 40% of the population. We're not really doing much better to change those outcomes.
We are nearly over the program. Frankie Guzman.
Yes, I mean, I agree with everybody, and I do agree that education is probably the greatest determinant of whether a person is going to stay out. But what I want to say is this. You know, I'm the youngest person in this room, and I've been in school probably most recently, and I continue to outreach to high schools. And what I can say about that is high schools and K-12 schools are more and more run like prisons. These are places where students are over-policed, heavily disciplined, and it creates a culture where they're pushed out. Those kids with learning disabilities, those kids with behavioral health issues are often those that are targeted for expulsion. If we were really serious about keeping these kids in, we would devote more resources into these schools, have more mentors that are of the background, of the experience, credible, authentic messengers that would help guide these kids and to stay on track. But the more that we invest in law enforcement and we defer to law enforcement, we lose that ability to invest resources.
Let me ask you all one further question because we're nearly out of time. This is a question coming from a listener. What do you think of schools adopting restorative justice practices instead of punishing kids who commit infractions? Who wants to respond first? Chris Areola.
We have restorative justice programs in Oakland, in San Jose, and they work. They tend to get cut when budgets go down, and they safe school means kids will stay there. So I think 100% we need to adopt these programs, but we have to have funding. You know, a kid in Palo Alto will get $16,000 per year from the state, and a kid in East San Jose and Alum Rock will get $8,000. That we need to switch that, or at least equalize it. That's a huge problem.
You know, but I think also DA's office should adopt a restorative justice model to dealing with youth offenders.
And we support it.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been great having you on the program, Judge Eugene Hyman, Frankie Guzman of the National Center for Youth Law, Steve Weichstaff, District Attorney, San Mateo County, Chris Areola, Supervising Deputy District Attorney, Juvenile Unit, Santa Clara County, and Jeff Hayden, President of the San Mateo County Bar Association. Thank you very much for joining us. I just want to let you know, everybody, that next week, if you join us, and I hope you do for your legal rights public radio, we'll have a discussion about personal injury law and medical malpractice law. My guest will be Keith Clifford, a civil trial specialist certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. And I just want to let you know who's helping me on this program. Program engineer Joanne Marr, production assistant Martin McLean. This segment of Your Legal Rights has been funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the San Mateo County Bar Association. Additional funding of the program is made possible by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association, and the California Applicants Attorneys Association. And last but not least, the National Board of Trial Advocacy is funding the satellite transmission of this program. Thank you for listening. Join us next week for Your Legal Rights Public Radio. I'm Chuck Finney.